live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect. A time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
Everybody, we're back. We were all ready to do the show last week, and I think Mercury kind of got into the system here at the radio station. So Angela's going to be back next week, and we're going to do what we were planning to do. But this week we have a really interesting topic, and in talking to our guest, it seems that we grew up in the same town, moved to Texas in the same place in the same year. So our paths have crossed until today, but, you know, life is a mystery, and everything that we do and the lives that we lead, the lives that our families lead, the lives that all people lead, sometimes there are very, very mysterious developments that go on, and some of them are very difficult to solve. And, you know, when we do genealogy, which we will be talking about today, there is a new form of genealogy that we're going to be broaching the subject today, and that's what we call forensic genealogy. And that's really more into some of the more investigative tips and tools that we use, and sometimes more intuitive than standard genealogy methodology. So today we have as our guest Colleen Fitzpatrick, and she has got her PhD in nuclear physics, interestingly enough, and has really spent most of her life in, you know, doing what we call forensic genealogy. So, Colleen, welcome.
Hello. Hello. How are you today?
I am doing great. So let's talk a little bit about your background and how one can go from being a nuclear physicist to a forensic genealogist.
Well, let's see. I have obviously a very solid scientific background. After I got my PhD in nuclear physics, I actually went into lasers and optics for many years. And when I retired in 2005, I wrote a book called Forensic Genealogy. Now, I, of course, I've been a genealogist all my life. And, you know, having that kind of scientific bent to the way I think, I had been doing genealogy this way forever, and I thought everyone else had been doing that too. But when I published the book, I found out that some of my ideas were very new and very exciting, and I was able to share them with people. I think the answer to your question is when you put genealogy in the same brain with somebody that does a lot of science and you mix it all up, it comes out to be forensic genealogy.
Interesting way to discuss it. And let's talk a little bit about what forensic genealogy really is.
The nearest I've been able to explain it is it's like CSI meets Roots. If a detective, say, is investigating a crime or looking for a missing person, that's a great analogy. What does he do? You know, he asks the relatives, he asks the neighbors, he looks up all the vital records on this person, finds their whereabouts, finds their family history, finds their likes and dislikes. And that's exactly what a genealogist does in researching a family or trying to find an ancestor. You know, looks up all the vital records, researches the family history, location, and what the person did for a living, where he may have gone after that. You know, the whole family history with marriages, divorces, ages of children. And so it's exactly the same thing. I call it CSI meets Roots. And that pretty much sums up, you know, what you do. You take the investigative part and the genealogy part and you combine them, and that's it, forensic genealogy.
Well, you know, I always said that the genealogy was really the same as, you know, what private investigators do, but you investigate dead people.
Yeah, but, yeah. And sometimes the investigators are investigating dead people. So, you know, there's no difference to me.
No, there isn't. And, you know, and that to me is what has been so fascinating about genealogy for me, mm-hmm. has been, you know, solving some of the mysteries, both in my family and, you know, and as I take on clients and solving some of the mysteries, you know, surrounding some of the cases that I take on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in as a forensic genealogist, I know that you do a lot of different types of projects with police departments and with, you know, the United States military and that kind of thing. And let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've worked on. I think people need to understand a little bit more by the projects, the kind of work that you do as a forensic genealogist and, you know, what some of us do, I think, is, you know, just plain old genealogists.
Yeah, if you have a specific case you'd like to talk about, that's fine. I find I do a lot of intuitive work. I find that a lot of times I get very discouraged and tired, and it's about the 30 seconds before I fall asleep at night that, bingo, I have the next idea. So I get up and I work on that, and, you know, usually it's usually when I get an idea like that, it's usually pretty valuable. And I do a lot of guessing, but I keep guessing. But it's good guessing and educated guessing. Now, my work, I find that genealogy seems to be anchored in reference materials and what websites to research. And that's good. And I can talk about where I find things. But my work, I think, is more encompassing. It's not the materials that I use to research. It's more like how I look at the materials I already have. So what I'd like to do in my career here in my life is open up genealogists' eyes to what they really have already in front of them and you know, incorporate the need for more websites and more reference materials and more online databases. You know, use that, and that's valuable, but step back and look at what you're doing. What is the process you're going through? What are you doing? And how are you using this material? And are you really looking at it the right way? I try to teach people to take the materials they have and look at them with new eyes.
That's, you know, it's amazing sometimes. You know, you can look at the same document one day and then put it away.
Mm-hmm.
And go and you know, look at the same document the next day, and all of a sudden something just, you know, pops out at you that mm-hmm. you really didn't see before.
Yeah.
And it's the clues. It's every piece of information that you get, whether it's a photograph, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a document, or whether it's communications with other family members, mm-hmm. there's something that sometimes will just, you know, give you the clue. My awakenings usually come in the mornings. You know, mm-hmm. I'll get up and before I open my eyes is when I have some of my best mm-hmm. Thoughts about what to do.
Yeah, but, like, why didn't I think of that before is a common question that I ask myself. Why didn't I think about that before?
Right, and a lot of times it's because we don't allow ourselves, in my opinion, to be open to the you know, the intuitive thoughts and feelings that we do. We get so focused sometimes and so into the work that we sometimes forget to back off and mm-hmm. and let the intuition, you know, and it, you know, take its course. And it's the same thing with just, you know, basic decisions that we make
mm-hmm. yeah.
in our day-to-day lives. But,
yeah.
You know, one of the cases that you know, I've seen your, you know, that you've done work on is the Benjamin Kyle case, the amnesia victim.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just find that fascinating because, you know, here is a young man who, you know, wandering around, I guess, and didn't even know who he is. And now how many years later is it?
He was found in 2007, badly
okay.
beaten. So that would be about 7 years, going on 7 years now.
And he didn't know who he was. He didn't have any identification with him.
Mm-hmm. No, no clothes, no identification. Just a man laying there, you know, presumed dead. And the police were called. He was found in a dumpster area behind a Burger King in the Savannah area. And the manager's wife went out early in the morning to throw the trash out, all the cartons, you know, for all the supplies that they were going to use for the day. And she stumbled on him and they called the police. The police collected him, assuming he was dead, but he was not. And when he revived, when he regained consciousness, he didn't know who he was. He was legally blind with cataracts. They were removed by, somebody donated the money to have the surgery done. And after they were removed, he said he looked in the mirror and he didn't even recognize himself because he said he couldn't believe that old man was him. You know, he couldn't believe, evidently he had the last he remembered of himself or had, you know, remembered seeing himself, he was much younger. So then, you know, that started a seven-year story about his search for his identity. And so far we've come up blank.
Interesting. I mean, you can isolate him to Savannah, of course.
No, we don't know. We know that's where he was found. But as far as we know, his memories indicate a childhood in Indianapolis. And he also can remember some about Boulder, Colorado in the 1980s, or late 70s, early 80s. And his memories are accurate enough and the kind of stuff that you wouldn't necessarily read in a magazine. They are, we judge them to be authentic. So we know that he was in those two places. And because of the, you know, he was maybe had a childhood in Indianapolis, we've gone there, not gone there, but gone there in a research sense to try and find any clues to his family, you know, his parents, you know, if he was adopted, if he was in an orphanage and that type of thing. But so far, no luck.
And how old was he about when you found him?
He believes his birthday was August the 29th, 1948. He believes that because he claims that he's 10 years younger than Michael, older than Michael Jackson, 10 years older than Michael Jackson. So at this year, he would turn, I guess that makes him 63 this year.
And no idea how long he may have been in Savannah, nothing.
No. I don't think he was there too long because, you know, after he was found, he wound up in a series of homeless shelters for 2 or 3 years. And, you know, nobody in those shelters recognized him. And I think that had he been from the Savannah area, not only, you know, the population in the homeless shelters would have recognized him, but he's been in the newspaper and on local television. Somebody would have come forward. So we don't think he was from Savannah. We think he came in from somewhere else. He was found across the street from a truck stop. So it's possible he was a body dump. You know, somebody tried to kill him. So it's possible he was homeless and, you know, he was blind. So somebody decided to pick on him or just beat him up and who knows. But I don't think he was from Savannah.
Interesting. So he could have been in some kind of a truck that was hauled from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or he could have been hitchhiking. You know, the population at truck stops is very transient. So, you know, somebody would come in, you know, get a ride in, and then say the truck driver needs to leave, but the passenger, the hitchhiker, is not there yet, you know, or doesn't pick up the ride further down. So, the truck driver leaves and leaves the hitchhiker there, and then the hitchhiker picks up another truck somewhere else. So, you know, there's no telling. I talked for a couple of hours to a friend of mine who is a truck driver, and you know, I asked him about truck stops, and he told me that it was a highly transient population. But I said also, if you were going to eat dinner, what would you do? And he said, I would not eat at the truck stop. I would eat at the Burger King because it's cheaper, faster. And so there you go, you know, sort of a connection between, you know, truckers eating at the Burger King. And the dumpster area where he was found was so hard to see from everywhere. From the road, from the hotel next door, from the gas station on the other side, that almost you had to have eaten at that Burger King and been aware that it was there to know it was there. So whoever put him there, or, you know, even if he ran, he could have just run there, he could have been scared and just ran in there, you know, by luck finding it. But Otherwise, if somebody left in there, they knew that dumpster area was back there and how remote it was.
And he has absolutely no recollection of his family or if he had a family or anything like that.
No, he has some vague memories that he had some brothers. Now, you know, who knows? He says that he thought he was the younger of several brothers. Now, I want to comment on what DNA has told us. Now, DNA is very interesting because it's something you can do apart from all these memories and all this documentation. He took a Y-DNA test that his closest matches were Powell's, P-O-W-E-L-L. So in the last 2 years, I've talked to so many Powells that, you know, let's say I know quite a few by now. And then he took another autosomal test from 23andMe that it basically chops up your DNA and figures out how much you share in common with other people that they have tested and then estimates your cousinship with these other people. And over time, I've, you know, collected, you know, he's had, you know, you have everywhere from close third cousins on back to 10th cousins, you know, lots. He has over 500 matches and in this big, big group of cousins. And, you know, I've asked many of them to give me their family trees, and I've made a map, and I've looked at them, and basically just about all of his close, say, top 10 matches have ancestry in the Western Carolinas, Eastern Tennessee. And so I think that he may not have been born in that area, but that his mother and father both have ancestry in the Western Carolinas, almost without question.
You know, interesting, because, you know, DNA came out for genealogy, I guess, back in, you know, 2000 is when I first became aware of it.
And yeah.
During my early days at Jewish Gen, you know, we were one of the first to, you know, start to consider using it as a tool to help put families together, and especially Jewish families at the time. And so I've had a very strong interest in the whole DNA concept. And I, you will enjoy this because when we first announced it, this was back in May of 2000. Boy, did we get rammed.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. You know, now everybody embraces it, of course. But those first few hours were probably one of the worst weekends I've ever spent in my life.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. You know, it was really pretty interesting. But, you know, the scientific value today, just as it is in police work, is as good as it is in genealogy work. It's really some of the same. It's almost exactly the same tools, same concepts that one uses for genealogy or doing police work, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is. And it's all, now I want to say that the law enforcement generally uses the CODIS markers. These are autosomal markers, autosomal, if you know STRs, short tandem repeats.
Sure.
That's the general kind of marker that genealogy uses on the Y, you know, for the Y chromosome. Those STRs actually exist on all of the chromosomes. And the law enforcement generally uses a set called the CODIS markers. And when law enforcement uses them, law enforcement is out to get an exact identification normally. Well, in criminal cases, they are. So that, you know, when they go into the NCIC or whatever the database is, they're looking for an exact match. And most states will restrict them to an exact match. There are maybe three states now that will allow fuzzy searches called familial matching. And there's a lot of issues with civil rights and stuff like that when you go past just an exact, you know, looking for an exact person.
Sure.
Now, law enforcement doesn't always test on the Y chromosome. They do in very, you know, severe cases or very interesting, you know, urgent cases. They don't normally do that. And I'm trying to get them to do more Y testing because I see a great value in them. You know, looking through the genetic genealogy databases to see if they can find a last name for people. Now, as far as missing persons, I do think that they do more of a fuzzy search looking for relatives, although the exact match would be the Holy Grail. I know that if somebody's missing, typically you'd have other family members' DNA on, in your database. And so I think that's a, you know, wider net that they cast. I'm somewhat less familiar with that, but I think that there is a lot of overlap between what law enforcement, missing persons type people do, and, you know, what genealogists do. It's not, a great overlap, but there is an overlap, and there's a potential for a far greater overlap and far greater cooperation between the two communities.
That's really kind of interesting and very exciting, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you've done a lot of Holocaust fraud cases, and, you know, just since, you know, my background, of course, is Jewish, and, mm-hmm. and have had, you know, worked in a lot of trying to reconnect, Jewish families after the Holocaust. How would you really kind of describe a fraud case? Is it somebody that is trying to reclaim perhaps things that were not really theirs to begin with? Or
I think it's a lot of it's about money.
Yes.
Money and recognition. You know, somebody gets, you know, either accidentally or on purpose recognized for, you know, an extraordinary type story. And it's hard to let go of that and say, no, it really didn't happen that way. Now, an honest person, you know, would say, no, it really didn't happen that way. But yet sometimes the story has a life of its own. I know occasionally I've been caught like that where, you know, somebody said, oh, my God, you're the person that, or, you know, in work, you know, you get credit for someone else's work. And, you know, I try to say, no, it really wasn't me. It was John Smith there. But, you know, sometimes you can't get through on that. So, but in these Holocaust cases, I think it was the people, you know, going after money, going after a community, you know, Jewish community is normally, you know, well-heeled, you know, well-off. And they see potential for, you know, large financial reward and also a lot of recognition that maybe they didn't have as children. I don't know. It's two sides to that.
Yep. It is probably more financially motivated, I would suspect.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sad too that you know, people try to take advantage of an old story to try to, you know, for financial gain or for, as you mentioned too, for the exposure.
Yeah, right. And I want to say there are certain, here's the intuitive part. And I want to say I'm working on a third one now that has consumed about the last 2 years of my research life along with Benjamin. I cannot say a lot about it except that it's set in the, I'd say, Eastern European countries. and that we pretty much have all of the information, but the main character is sitting on a lot of information that he won't give up about himself, which is highly unusual for a Holocaust survivor. Normally, a Holocaust survivor wants you to know who he is and wants to, you know, provide the documentation about his experiences, but not this guy. But I want to say that this is a good example of intuitive work, because as I've been on my third Holocaust fraud now, I've noticed patterns of how the stories are built and then how they get, you know, into the public eye and then how they change and how the person, the main character, behaves along the way. And, you know, that has given me a lot of clues on the third Holocaust fraud because it's, you know, psychologically very similar to the first two. And, you know, mainly it's a story about a child, you know, poignant, incredible survival against the absolute ultimate evil. And so initially, you know, from the start, it has a lot of appeal. You know, people want to believe in the triumph of good over evil. So from the beginning, it's very hard to come out and say, well, it's not true, because a lot of people want to believe it's not true. I mean, excuse me, want to believe it's true. And then as the story begins, it's and develops, there's a lot of an initial period of uncertainty about, you know, kind of feeling, the person feels their way in the dark historically or personally and says, you know, a few things. And then the story gets tightened up, It usually comes to the public eye when the person that wrote it has been in financial distress. The person, you know, looking back on records, you know, loses their house or sometimes it claims financial distress or is in financial distress, but makes a lot of money in the background without saying it. In the very early stages, there's a lot of patches that are applied to the story as people start asking questions about, well, how could that possibly have happened? You know, the person is usually kind of an unsavory person who has had shady business dealings along the way. The story is normally set in a foreign country where you believe you cannot access the records easily so that they can sort of hide in history, you know, in countries that were basically decimated during the war. So that the, you know, number one, if the records exist, they're hard to access. And they're in a foreign country, like, you know, not one of the first world countries normally. And then, you know, it's normally in a different language. So, you know, for Herman Rosenblatt, some of those records were in Polish, some were in Russian. For Misha, a lot of them were in French, which was not too bad. And this new one is in, you know, anything from Russian to Latvian, Lithuanian. And so, you know, unless you are feel comfortable and you don't feel challenged by the language barrier, you know, if you feel challenged by the language barrier, then, you know, most people would be. They wouldn't attempt to find the records in the first place. So, you know, you're dealing with a poignant, very beautiful triumph story of triumph of a small child against massive evil, and that is hard to document or impossible to document. The story, as people start to find, you know, contradictions, the subject patches over the story and explains around the problems. And then finally, it attracts the attention of publishers, international publishers. The book comes out. You know, it's headed to the movie format, and then, you know, hopefully sooner or later they get caught.
And then, you know, the other cases that you've had, I mean, you know, I have a distant relationship to the Strauss family who went down on the Titanic and had an opportunity to go with the Strauss family to see the Titanic on Broadway. And there was a case that you were involved in with the Titanic.
Yes, I was. I actually was. It was on the tail end. I was working on The Hand in the Snow with the Armed Forces Lab. And as that wound down, the Titanic baby was coming through the lab, the identification of the DNA identification of the baby. And so at the end, when it was, nobody thought we could do it through mitochondrial DNA. We just couldn't. They had two babies that were almost identical in mitochondrial DNA. And so they asked me to go out and find a Y reference, somebody who was descended along the direct male line to the Goodwins, who were, Sidney Goodwin was possibly one of the could have been the baby that, you know, they were testing that out. So at the end, I went out and the Y family reference had been completely neglected along the way. So my part was to find that Y reference. Now, in the long run, right at the last minute, the last hope, breath of hope, the baby was identified through mitochondria. I have this on my blog at identifinders.wordpress.com. It was so the person that I found was not used by the lab. But on the other hand, it reunited the Goodwin family. You know, another member of the family got, you know, identified and, you know, pulled into the community there. And I went out to the memorial for Sidney Leslie Goodwin in Halifax, you know, right after that. But I want to say there are hundreds of genealogists involved. I played a small role at the end. It was significant, but it was small. But I have to give credit to the hard work that, you know, genealogists did really all over Europe and the United States, and also to Ryan Parr and his crew for the DNA analysis they did.
So, you know, this is really one of the things that genealogists do get involved in is helping, you know, solve mysteries, whether it's events like the Titanic or any plane crashes or you know, fraud cases, anything that really is trying to either prove or disprove that someone was either there or not there, or who they are or where they go. It's really very, very interesting work that you do. And
thank you.
I do some of it myself, and I love this part of the work that I do. I don't do it all the time, but I do have a case here and there that I get to spend some time, trying to solve. And I've been very successful so far, so I get really excited. I think it's really exciting kind of work.
Yeah, there's nothing like, you know, when you have that success and you see that birth date that matches the one you're looking for. You know, it's nothing like it. And I want to say one of the benefits is I've reunited, you know, several families or several adoptees with their birth parents. And it's so wonderful. You know, you feel that excitement and that happiness and that completeness that you have allowed someone by your work.
Exactly. I'm going to open up the phones if anybody wants to call in, if they have any questions, if you have a mystery in your family that you might want some ideas on how to solve. This is the time. The number is 888-815-9756. And Colleen is here to take your calls if you want to call in. So, how did you begin to get involved in really all of these, you know, exciting cases that you're working on? I mean, we've talked about some of them, and there's a list. And the other thing, too, I'd like for you to give out your website before we go too much further, too.
Okay. My forensic genealogy website is it's a www.forensicgenealogy.info. And that is I use it as a hobby website. I have photo quizzes every week. It's always an interesting question to research. Some of them are harder than others, but it's always an interesting topic. So I invite people to surf in. My professional website is www.identifinders.com. IdentifinderS.com, just like it sounds. And that's where I have listed a lot of the cases I've worked on, each, you know, with links to various newspaper articles and interviews regarding the case. I think that, and that's, if people have something they'd like to ask me about or talk to me about, that's the way to really contact me. All the email goes right to me. I got into it just because I did. I love every minute. And now I just got lucky. I'm very good at what I do. The forensic book came out, and I thought it would be a nice hobby thing. But when you're a rocket scientist, you can't leave well enough alone. And pretty soon I was working for an international investment company, finding people all over the world. And it was so much fun. I called Morocco, Estonia, Lebanon, South America, North America, Canada, the Far East, Australia. I mean, I just found people under rocks, and I really enjoyed it. I'm multilingual, so I'm pretty fearless in calling Onga Bunga Land if I have to. And so that worked out. And in the middle of that, I got an email from Terry Barton, who works on worldfamilies.net. It's a site for DNA projects for genealogists. And he told me he had been contacted by the Armed Forces DNA lab who were trying to identify a frozen human arm in a glacier found in Alaska. Well, of course, you can't leave that alone. You know, okay, you have to ask. No, what's that again? Can you run that by me again? And he explained that, you know, the Armed Forces had been working on it for a while. And there were 30 people on the plane, and they were all servicemen. I think there was 24 servicemen going on leave, and there were 6 crew members that were retired servicemen, and they all died in a crash in Alaska in 1948. The lab had eliminated, at that time, 25 of them by DNA or by fingerprints, and they had gotten hung up on a man named Olin Jacobson, who was a cook on the oil tanker that these men had been stationed on. And, you know, so they had, you know, it was getting harder and harder. The more they identified, the harder it was to identify the remaining ones because they were the grungies at the bottom. And so anyway, Terry told me about this. He eventually forwarded me all the information. And I was in Guatemala at the time on vacation, and I got online, got on Ancestry, and found that family within about an hour. And, of course, the the Armed Forces Lab are not genealogists, you know, so they were like stunned, like, how did you do that? I think it was kind of harder than I make it out, but they were especially impressed because they, you know, they have no knowledge of any of that. And they had been hung up for many weeks on this particular guy. Well, in the end, I thought, isn't that nice? I'm glad I helped. But in the end, it wasn't a match. The DNA of his family member did not match the DNA in the remains. So that left five more people on the plane that it could be. And, you know, as it got toward the end, we finally had two left. The second to last was a man, you know, obscure guy born in Vermont. And it took a lot of power genealogy to get through that because his mother was an Irish immigrant from the 1890s who, you know, if you've done any genealogy, you know that Irish said nothing about themselves. And in the end, it took some power Irish genealogy to track down his family member, who was like a second cousin twice removed or something. The common ancestor was in 1800 in Ireland. And, I mean, this never happens, let me tell you that, to be able to do that and make that family tree like that from the Irish. But that was the match. And, you know, so at that point, you know, that received a lot of attention in the media. And from that point, you know, I got involved in the Titanic baby because they were doing that. Amelia Earhart Project, they were doing that. I'm involved with that. And then other, you know, things started rolling in. So now the rest is history.
Well, that's, that's really exciting. I mean, I've always felt, and I've said this on the show many times, that, you know, everybody life needs to be documented, whether they, you know, whether they're, you know, at the time of their death. And the thing that upsets me more than anything, and I've said this before, are all the people who have died in some of these terrible tragedies that have, you know, existed in you know, Indonesia and mm-hmm. Haiti and Japan, and mm-hmm. and bodies are gone or lost forever mm-hmm. or buried or not buried, and mm-hmm. you know, these lives are just totally, you know, snuffed out. Mm-hmm. There's no memorial. There's no reference. There's no nothing.
Yeah.
And that has always bothered me. And that's really what started me in genealogy when I mm-hmm. started off as a hobbyist, is there were too many people buried in a grave and nobody knew who they were.
Yeah, right. And there's a lot of work today on mass graves, you know, clandestine graves and mass graves. So, you know, there's hope. The problem is huge. So, you know, you never will be able to rescue everyone from the dead, so to speak. But there's a lot of interest in mass graves and clandestine graves. There's a whole area of research that, you know, promises some hope for those people.
Well, I want to give out the phone number one more time. It's 888-815-9756. This is the time to call in if you've got a question or want to ask a particular question about the subject of forensic genealogy or how one goes about it. I think, you know, that it really needs to be part of, you know, a genealogist's toolbox, so to speak, because, you know, not every family has a, you know, straight line back to
Charlemagne.
Yes, either that or as Ashley Judd had a straight line back to the Mayflower descendants in the recent Who Do You Think You Are series. So, there are always some interesting things. I mean, and we all find out about it about our family. I mean, I had a particular situation where, you know, on my father's side, and I know people don't like hearing all the stories, but it was very interesting. And my dad always recounted the story that in the middle of the night, he and his mother grabbed all the kids, and they took off for California out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew why. Nobody, or they wouldn't say. And I was in Chicago, probably 20 years ago, and I went into the clerk of courts, mm-hmm. and I sat down for the time period, and I put the microfilm in, and the first case was my grandfather's.
Oh, interesting.
And I found out exactly why they left, and the family, you know, moved to California, and then they were all reunited in New Orleans, where you and I both grew up. So, nobody told us. And nobody told my dad. My dad had no clue.
Yeah.
It was really amazing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so terrible. It's just, it was one of those little mysteries.
Yeah. Right.
That we all have in our family. So give us a call, 888-815-9756.
Yeah. While we're waiting, I could make a couple of comments about children. I just want to say this, that we talk about intuition, and I've described the Holocaust frauds, how this present one just smells like a fraud. You know, it has a lot of characteristics of it. But Benjamin's case is very similar to another case I worked on, a man who was a fugitive from the United States, wound up in Australia in 1924, and changed his name. He went under a pseudonym of John Henderson Gray. And when he died in 1970, his wife and five children had no idea who he had been. So here we have a man without a real last name. We know kind of where he came from United States. We know they knew his birthday was probably April 14th, 1893. Same as Benjamin. You know some geography, you know a probable birthday, you don't have a last name. So they went nuts for 40 years, I mean all their lives, but after he died for 40 years trying to find out who he was. His daughter contacted me after she had gone to a psychic who told her dad's last name was Fitzpatrick. So she got in touch with me and she said, "Have you ever heard of a John Fitzpatrick?" Well, so let me think about that. Maybe, I don't know. The brother took a DNA test, and it took 6 years. In 2008, we finally got a match against the name Smithers. And within a couple of hours, I had the dad's identity here in the United States. We found out he had been married twice before he went to Australia. He had three kids by those two marriages, two of whom are in their 80s and still are alive. And the son had been looking for what happened to his father, since he was 18 months old, really, but as an adult for the last 65 years or so. So he got the call one day that, guess what? Some lady in California found your dad. Well, what lady's that? I mean, it was just sort of out of the blue. Now we're putting two and two together. And the real important thing is that the people in Australia had been trying to look in the United States for who this guy was. The people, his family in the United States knew he had been in Australia, and they were looking for him in Australia. But the two groups couldn't connect. It was only through DNA that, bang, there it was. So in analogy to Benjamin, the search is the same. It's some guy with no name. The man in Australia gave the first names of his parents. He said he had a brother and a few sisters. Well, Benjamin says he has a few brothers. The man in Australia said he was from Texas. He probably actually did live there. Benjamin says he was from Indianapolis, or we think he was in Boulder, Colorado. So you see, you have, and the man in Australia, we knew he was a farmer and he was in the oil industry because that's what his skills were. The man, Benjamin, is a genius about the restaurant industry and knows about restaurant management and construction. So we know what he probably did for a living. And the analogies are all there. So I think that in the end, I've gleaned some other sort of psychological, intuitive things about Benjamin along the way from the previous case. And I think that in the end, it will be DNA that solves it.
I would suggest that's probably going to be the case. But what is so amazing is that, nobody has been looking for him. I mean, there's so many different missing person sites things like that.
I want to say we don't know that because, as I said, the people in the United States were looking in Australia, and the people in Australia were looking in the United States, and they just couldn't connect. So I think that hard is it to believe that there are people that don't look at Dr. Phil. He did appear on Dr. Phil. Or I know that people, in hindsight, people have come to me saying they tried to contact Dr. Phil about possible leads that they never heard back about. There's when somebody goes to the police sometimes, a missing adult male in 50 years old, sometimes they're told, he's got a girl friend. You know, he had financial problems, and there the family is dismissed. And that's, you know, police handle violent crime, and I'm not criticizing them. I mean, this is a triage. You know, if the man is not in mortal danger, then they will attend to, like, say, children or violent crime, where there is a question of life and death. So his family, I would think, probably is looking for him, but we just don't know how to find them, and they don't know how to find us. I mean, that's another analogy with the guy in Australia. I wouldn't be surprised if they were looking for him, or they gave up by now.
Well, and a lot of people do give up. I mean, you know, I've got a case right now that, the family gave up for 15 years, and you know, they're making one last ditch effort to see if they can find it. And, you know, today we've got the internet, and we've got a lot more tools at our disposal, where 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have a whole lot.
Yeah, that's true. You see, that's you know, and of course, DNA was what did it. And, you know, 15, 20 years, we couldn't have done that. You know, we wouldn't have had, even if we had DNA, we'd have nothing to research and match it against. You know, we wouldn't have anywhere to go with it. But now we do because of the big databases that are online.
Right, right. So for those who are interested in this field, because we've got a few closing minutes, what would you suggest to those of us? And I'm going to put my hat in the ring for this. What do you suggest we do if we're interested in this modality of genealogy?
I have a great suggestion. There is a website, and I think the URL is www.missing-identities.net. And this is a website for the people from the Holocaust who were hidden children or who got lost in the, you know, their family was running away and they fell off the truck or something. And these people have no idea who they are. And many of them are in their 70s and 80s, and some have unfortunately died. And they have spent their whole life trying to find out who they are, where their family is, you know, who they are. I would suggest going there. There's 80 cases on that website, many of which have not been solved. And read each person has a research journal. So number one, you can read a lot about these champions that have spent their life researching themselves. But there's one case of a small girl. She now goes by the name of Mary, but her birth name was Michelle Annette. And she doesn't know much. She knows she was in an orphanage in France in 1940. She came to the United States in 1941. She has a picture of herself at a birthday party at the orphanage in August of 1940. She has another picture of herself in early 1941 with an adoptive family in the United States. She was part of quite a large group of children that were taken by this orphanage or this organization, OSC, to the United States out of danger's harm's way and adopted out. She researched, when she arrived, her adoptive family tore up her identity papers, essentially kidnapping her from herself, from her own life. She's in her 70s, I believe. She's spent her whole life trying to figure out who she is. Now, she was reading a book called Never Wave Goodbye a few years ago, and it was talking about this exodus of children from Europe to the United States. And she saw a picture of a bunch of children arriving in New York Harbor on a boat, and she saw herself in the picture. She was, she recognized her dress, her hair, because it corresponded to what she looked like in that picture with her adoptive family in early 1941. So she's, knows the children are leaning over the railing. You see the back of the children waving to the Statue of Liberty. And she's in the arms of an attendant, like a nurse or a chaperone, and she's facing the camera. She knows that's herself. So I throw it out to the people who are interested in researching these very interesting cases to go look up Michelle Annette at missing-identities.net. And because the children are dressed for summer, and she's got pictures in August 1940 and then early 1941, so the boat must have arrived in August or September of 1940 into New York Harbor. So if you can find the passenger manifest, if you can find where she is, what ship she came on, you could probably find her identity or find the clues that would lead to her identity. And I know she would be eternally grateful for that.
you know, I've been involved in you know, trying to help, you know, people who you know, lost their identity during the Holocaust. And, you know, I want to recount a story, and I never did finally solve it. But, you know, I did a lot of what you did, and this was back in the 1980s or mid-80s. And it was a young boy who, you know, his story was is that he was in a school, and the Germans came, and he and his brother ran from the school, and it was in Belozerkov, which is in the Ukraine. And they got to the forest, and one brother went one way and the other brother went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And he evidently got picked up by the SS, and he was brought into Germany. He served as a child slave, and he didn't know his name. And I mean, I did a lot of the same thing that you did. I mean, it was just heart wrenching. And I, mm-hmm. you know, I went and met him in Bodega Bay in California. Mm-hmm. And I was traveling to Belozerkov, and I went to Belozerkov, and I could not find any hide nor hair of the school.
Oh.
You know, but I looked. I mean, you know, I knew it was by the river. I mean, you know, I mean, I pretty much took pictures.
Yeah.
But during the course of this, and I mean, I'm telling you this, it had to be maybe 1992.
Yeah.
Because I was working with a fellow who owned he ran a bulletin board service out of Kiev,
yeah.
which was prior to the internet. This is how long ago it was.
Yeah.
And he and I were communicating one night about this, and he was going to help me earlier on in the research. And it happened to be when they started taking over,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was Glasnost is what it was. And, you know, he was freaking out because they were setting fire to the television station. And I mean, it was total commotion.
Mm-hmm.
And he had no idea what was going on. And this is what is so fascinating about working internationally, which I've done for many, many years,
mm-hmm.
is that I ended up spending all night. I mean, I stayed up all night, and I would be listening to the news, and I would send him messages before the internet through the,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and I would keep him posted as to what was going on in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a very fascinating night. And I got mm-hmm. up, and about 5 o'clock in the morning, I ran and got a newspaper, got pictures. I scanned the pictures in. Mm-hmm. I emailed him copies of the pictures.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it was just a really kind of an incredible story evening. And you know, again, some of these cases, I guess, and you know, this was long before DNA testing, too.
Yeah.
So, but there are so many stories about people who are just either mysteries or missing mm-hmm. identities, don't know who they are, don't know who their
yeah.
families are, and not just plain adoptees. It really makes this work so rewarding, or even trying.
Yeah.
I mean, they really appreciate somebody taking an interest in their case or taking an interest mm-hmm. in helping them because they don't know where to start.
Yeah, and I want to. What you said is so true about the community. You know how we have such a great community on the internet that. I mean, you know, especially when you're dealing with a situation like that, you know, in a foreign country, that it makes it so good that you can look for nice people and helpful people on the other side of the world, you know, that can contribute or help you out or answer questions. And we should not forget that. I keep forgetting that. And every now and then, you know, I have something that just totally, you know, confuses and how am I going to do this? And I say, well, you know, go on the internet and there you go. You know, there are nice people out there that are willing to help.
There really are. And, you know, for those of us who you know, like yourself, who do it, do our work professionally,
mm-hmm.
You know, there are times where we, you know, do take cases that, I mean, I take cases that are pro bono on occasion where people
yeah.
can't afford,
yeah.
You know, because it's something that really, you know, is stimulating.
Yeah, yeah.
And, You know, and a lot of the audience, too, is into the very intuitive mode of things. And, mm-hmm. you know, there are a lot of people that I know who are in the spiritual community who do a lot of missing persons work, too.
Yeah. Good for them.
So, you know, it really is, to me, a very big match. I mean, whether you do it genealogically or you do it intuitively and spiritually, or you bring the two together, which is what I think the way of the world should be, you know, it does make for a you know, something that we can all get involved in. Because, you know, yeah. people like to know who they are.
Yeah, I would like to, before we close, just make a plug about the books that I have available. They will help people get the hang of it. I have a couple of more books I'm working on now, Advanced DNA and on Finding People. But to get the hang of it, to get the idea, I wrote a book called Forensic Genealogy that you can find on my website. I have a book called DNA and Genealogy that is sort of a how-to on genetic genealogy, but we decided not to make it so dry by adding these boxes and these sidebars on DNA in the news and weird DNA stories. So that if you hear about cloning on the news, for example, you'll get it, and you know it's the same DNA that you're using for genetic genealogy. You'll get a feel for the big picture. And we have stories about the DNA of the Iceman and DNA of Anna Anderson, you know, who thought she was Anastasia, the star's daughter. DNA on exobiology, if we find life out there in the cosmos, you know, what kind of DNA are we looking for? All kind of interesting stories like that. And then the last book is The Dead Horse Investigation, Forensic Photo Analysis for Everyone. And the cover of that is a picture of a man sitting on a dead horse in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So it's a very interesting picture. And if you think you've had a bad day, think about this poor guy, you know, in the 1870s. I mean, that's really the bottom, you know, in Sheboygan of all places. It's a nice place, but it was the end for vaudeville, as far as people on vaudeville finally got to the end of the line when they played Sheboygan. So anyway, yeah, just surf in. My books are available on both websites. Thanks for letting me say something about them.
And oh, you're welcome.
People are, you know, welcome to contact me for further information or to get help on a particular project or maybe just a nudge on a particular project. That'd be good. So thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I am so glad we made this contact for more ways than one. I mean, I think it's just a riot that we grew up in the same place. We moved yeah. to the same place in the same year.
Yeah.
So I guess... it was we were meant to connect at this point, perhaps.
I guess we were.
I think we were. In any event, thank you so much for your time. I think the work that you do is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
And again, if you need to contact her, it's www.forensicgenealogy.info or www.identifinders.com. Colleen Fitzpatrick, PhD.
Okay.
Thanks again.
All right.
This is Susan King. You can reach me at www.susaneking.com. Hope y'all have a great week. We will see you back here next Tuesday.
Okay. Bye.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week, we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.